when I started this series, so my opening words were about my own upbringing and my own parents and how much of an impact that made on me in terms of my my own passion for Tzion, for our Tzion HaKadosha. I imagine that I am not unique in that regard. I would venture a guess that the vast majority of us in this room had parents who were very passionate about the state of Israel. One quick anecdote, as my father Avimori walks in. So my grandfather was a child of the early turn of the 20th century, and as was the minhag back then, always that the appropriate proper way for a gentleman to dress was to put a hat on when they went out in the street. And my father's been telling me this story, as Michael's usually pretty mocked about. So my father's been telling me this story my whole life, that after the Milchamat HaShechrur, Elliot, after the good work that your father and his comrades were able to accomplish, that my grandfather, for all of a sudden, wanted to, Abba, you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, that my grandfather suddenly wanted to walk out with his yarmulke. And what it engendered was this immense, intense, profound pride, religious pride, that for the first time, and he was certainly not alone, he wanted to display to the world, I'm a Jew. I'm a proud Jew. I'm a passionate Jew. My grandfather was Shomer Shabbos every day of his life, which was in and of itself a novel back then. But the fact that suddenly he was able to wear it on, he not only was able to, but wanted to wear it on his sleeve, I think was just emblematic of how significant of a moment in the history of the Jewish people, not only for the history of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, but in the history of the Jewish people in the diaspora as well. What a significant moment. The Chavtep, November 29th, 1947, and May of 1948, and of course the armistice agreements in 1949. What really, all of those three dates probably are more than anything gave birth to Medina Israel. So I just want to, by way of introduction, I haven't mentioned this enough. We are all passionate and ardent Tzionim, not only because of our own sophisticated passions that we harbor, but also because of our forerunners. And Elliot, since it's not a yard site, and we can talk about your father's accomplishments, not just in terms of his own life, but in terms of what he represented, I think it's an important opportunity to dedicate this year not only to the memory of Elliot's father, but in the memory of all of our parents and all of our forerunners who played such an important and significant contribution and significant role in our own in shaping of our own ideology. So may all of their collective memories be for a blessing, and may the passions that they engendered in all of us continue and only grow for many years to come. Okay, so we've spoken about a lot of things in the last few weeks. I can't thank everybody enough for coming and for showing up and continuing to show up for all of these lectures. I wanted to discuss the modern era. And as I kind of closed with this last week, a big goal of mine in this discussion is to take the world of Tzionut, the world of Zionism today, away from, or I certainly expand it from, what is so often limited to the world of Herzl and his, the aftermath of Herzl and his movement. We started with a couple of definitions. I scoured a few different dictionaries and I pasted them for you. And if you remember, most of the definitions said nothing other than it's a modern day political movement to establish a state. One of the definitions said reestablish a state. One of the definitions actually named two figures. Remember who they were? Anybody was here? So Herzl was one and Weizmann was the other. All right, Weizmann is left out of these sheets. I apologize, but I had to. I've had 8 pages. I could have had 80, and I had to stop somewhere. So Herzl and Weizmann, and a big part of what I've been wanting to do was to expand on this popular notion out in the world of where Tzionut comes from. I've argued already from the first year that we had that Tzionut was born with the world. That it was in the very early plans, at least if not in the dawn of creation, then at least from the time of the Shechrur, of the Exodus from Gan Eden, that the idea of the Am HaNivchar, the Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, serving as a model of an Or LaGoyim, a model for the rest of the world, and where we are charged with the opportunity and the obligation of representing an ideal in terms of governing ourselves, in terms of how to relate with the world, in terms of how to relate with with the land that we live in, and how to establish a government and an economy. I think that that's very much the plan from the dawn of time. So to limit our discussion to just Herzl and Chaim Weizmann And even David Ben-Gurion in Medina Israel in 1948 and on is such a disservice to what Tzionut really is and what it represents at the heart of our people. So that was really the general goal of the first three shiurim. Right now I want to get to the modern era and see where Herzl fell in. Now, I titled it From Herzl to Netanyahu. We're going to discuss Herzl. We're not going to discuss Netanyahu. I just wanted to give off the notion that we're going to be speaking about the modern era. But I think it's important to realize that we can't talk about Herzl in a vacuum. Right? It's not just we can't talk about Herzl in a vacuum, therefore take a look at what we've done in the last 3 weeks. I think we can't talk about Herzl in a vacuum even when we start talking about the world of modern Jewish history, the era of modern Jewish history, from the 18th century and on. From the period of the Enlightenment, which ultimately gave birth to nationalism across the world, of which a part was Jewish nationalism, which resulted ultimately in Medinat Yisrael. We can't start from Herzl and the Dreyfus Affair in the 1890s and Herzl's reaction to it, and then the starting of the World Zionist Organization. Because you always need to ask, whenever you're looking at history, you always need to ask, okay, well, where did that come from? Herzl didn't come up with this idea out of nowhere. Herzl didn't say, "Oh, this is a real anti-Semitism that's going on here." So, but I have a good idea. Let's go. Everybody should move to Palestine. It was coming from somewhere. He didn't get it from nowhere. So, I wanted to start in the initial stage from the lead up, a little bit of a lead up to Herzl. We're going to back up a few decades. The first source, all right, and we're going to go through pretty much what we're going to do today is go through several personalities. Where I could, I got text in Hebrew, and we'll read it in the original. Where the original text was German, I apologize, my German is very poor. So I have an English translation. And a couple of the last texts I actually could have gotten in Hebrew, but I just didn't have the available Sfarim for me. So I put it in English. But we'll read what we can. We're going to go through a lot of several thinkers, several theorists of Zionism, starting from the 18th century and on. So, number one. Yehuda Alkalai. Anybody ever hear of him? Yehuda Alkalai was an important figure, very unique in terms of everybody that we're going to discuss, because he was the only, of the people that we're going to discuss, and I don't mean to say that he was the only one, but he was the only Sfaradi of the figures that we're going to discuss. As we all know, the movement of modern political Zionism was born not in the countries of Muslim rule, but it was born in Western Europe. It was born of the Enlightenment, and it was born of the reaction to anti-Semitism as the Jews were becoming assimilated in Western Europe, and the reaction to that. It was conceived of, Zionism, as we know, as a safe haven for the Jews of Russia and the Jews of Poland who were being persecuted ad nauseum. Yehuda Alkalai is actually the exception, and it's significant that we're starting from him because I think it highlights again that none of this was coming out of nowhere. So Yehuda Alkalai, he was born in Sarajevo, in Bosnia, all right. And if I did like I did last week, I have a corresponding map on the last page, so just so that everybody has an idea of where some of these places that we're talking about. The divisions of the countries are the modern day map, so everybody has a good idea. But the names of the towns that I've highlighted, some of them are no longer in use. Some of them are the Jewish pronunciations. So you see Sarajevo, which is in Bosnia, it's all the way down here. You see Bosnia and there's Croatia over here, so Sarajevo's over here. So we're actually getting closer to this is the Muslim territory, which is why we're dealing with a Sfaradi. So Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai was a very significant person. He studied, he grew up and lived in Sarajevo, but he actually left for a time to study in Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. We mentioned last week in the Middle Ages when famous Jews started going back to Israel and establishing yeshivot, so that legacy lived on for centuries. And one of the things that happened, we discussed it in the north in the 16th century, in the late 15th, early 16th century, when Rav Shlomo Levi Alkabetz and Rav Yosef Karo started moving. That was really the, we talk in rock and roll, as the British invasion in the, in the 60s in the U.S. So that was really the Kabbalistic invasion in the 16th century in Eretz Yisrael. The Lahavdil. I was going to get a talking to after that if I didn't use that. It didn't give that qualifier.
Wait, which way?
Paul McCartney should forgive me. This was really the birth of the Kabbalah in Eretz Yisrael really happened with the immigration of the Kabbalists in Tzfat in the 16th century. So there became these centers of Kabbalah that spread throughout Eretz Yisrael. And already in the 13th century, the Ramban going to Yerushalayim and establishing a shul there, that was really the kickstart to a fledgling but persistent and continuous Jewish community that had been gone for centuries but continued for centuries past him. So Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai leaves Sarajevo and goes to Yerushalayim to study in yeshiva. And while he's there, he didn't come from a particularly Kabbalistic background, but while he was there, he became very influenced from the world of Kabbalah. Really important piece of historical information. Anybody here ever hear of the Damascus Affair? Anybody? The Damascus, does the phrase ring a bell to anyone? So the Damascus Affair was one of, unfortunately, several blood libels that happened in 1840. It happened in Damascus. Now, what's unique about the Damascus Affair is that it was, like all blood libels, it was a complete farce, and it was this, one of the unfortunate consequences of the Jews being ghettoized and living in a separate community is that everybody that wasn't a member of the Jewish community had absolutely no idea what any of the Jewish rituals were about. They didn't understand it. They knew vaguely, all right, everybody doesn't go to work. If I have this Jewish merchant that works for me, this guy that I trade with, this guy that is that I do banking with, I know that he doesn't come to work or he doesn't do business on such and such holiday. But I have no idea what's going on. There's only a very small connection to the different types of Jewish rituals that existed. So when somebody is completely foreign, it works like any xenophobia. When somebody is completely foreign and you're completely unfamiliar with their culture, you can start a rumor and it's very easily believed. Because who's to refute it? So somebody said, as this happened so many times, it still happens in some of the Arab press, it blows my mind. But somebody in the 1840s, in the year 1840, started a blood libel. The Jews are killing Christian babies to use their blood to bake matzah for Pesach. And while this happened in Damascus, right, which I didn't even mark Damascus, but you know where Damascus is. It's northeast of Israel, right, in Syria. Half a world away, all the way in Europe, word got to Western Europe. And it spread like wildfire. And that was a source of a lot of anti-Semitism spurned again. And this time in Western Europe. And this, right now we're in the heart of the Enlightenment. This is in the 1840, this is a period in history where the assimilation was huge in the Jewish community in Western Europe. In Germany, in France, the Jewish people were now becoming members of the community like anybody else, and for the first time in their history, really letting go of tradition. Herzl's grandfather, whom we'll meet in a minute, was a student and a congregant of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. Herzl's grandfather. His name was Shimon Leib Herzl. And he operated in. He was born in Sarajevo, and then he goes back and is the rabbi in a town called Semlin, right? And that is all right. I marked that off on the map also. Now, if you see where Semlin is, all right, we'll get back to it. But the Herzls, Theodor Herzl was born in Budapest. So if you see Semlin was east of Sarajevo, north is Budapest. So it's not that far away. So this guy, Shimon Leib Herzl's son, is the one who becomes first assimilated. And we all know the standard series of Jewish assimilation. The grandfather is the one with all the tradition. The first generation from him who was assimilated is sensitive to tradition, but is not interested at all and raises his children completely without any affiliation. And then by the third generation, Yiddishkeit is completely gone. This is a story throughout the long history of assimilation. That's what happened. Shimon Leib Herzl was a congregant and a student of Yehuda Alkalai. And he davened in his shul, and they knew each other for years. His grandson eventually is the person that we know, will eventually become to know as Theodor Herzl. Which is fascinating, because as we're going to see in a second in these texts, Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, who had a profound influence on Herzl's grandfather, was an ardent Zionist, and was one of the first people in the modern era to speak out publicly and write publicly about the need and the importance and significance of Shivat Zion. Okay, so let's take a look over here. Minchat Yehuda, he wrote a lot of things. Minchat Yehuda is a work of Jewish philosophy in which a big part of which he argues for the importance of emigration to Eretz Yisrael. Itza b'Gemara Yevamot. So the Gemara in Yevamot says, we're on source number 1 on page 1. Tanu Rabbanan. Right? So, "Malamed she'ena shechina shora al pachot mishnei alpaim u'shnei revivot mi'Yisrael." We know now, because of this Gemara, the Gemara says that the Shechina can only be shore, can only rest on 22,000 Jewish people. "V'anu mitpalalim b'chol yom," and we daven, this is Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai saying, we daven every single day, "v'techazena einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion b'rachamim." We daven every day in Shemot Esrei that we should see the return to Tzion. "Al mi yishra Shechinato, al ha'itzim v'alavanim." On who is what's going on? Think about it. He's writing in the 1840s. There's a very this is before the first major wave of Aliyah. So there's very little Jewish presence going on in Eretz Israel. And he says, what is it that we want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rest his presence on? On stones and stones and wood? That's what's left there. It's the place is in ruins. Our homeland is rubble. Im kein tchila v'rosh lepidyon nafshenu. The first step, the first stage in the redemption of our souls, chayavim anu lahashiv la'artzenu, and this is fascinating, the way he says this, shnayim yesri melech. What do we need to do? We don't need mass immigration, but the only way that we're going to achieve redemption, the only way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to rest his Shechina on us, is if 22,000 people move to Eretz Israel. We need a community of 22,000 people in order to fulfill the dictum of this Gemara on Masechet Yevamot. So that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to rest His presence on them. And only after that event occurs, 22,000 people are living in Eretz Yisrael, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Shechina is going to rest on them, and then the Jewish people will do okay. Alright, so keep in mind, this sounds like the words of the Kabbalist. Alright, this is not a practical political message. This is a Gemara with a very mystical bend to it. And he's saying, though, what we need to do, brass tacks, this is a blueprint for how we achieve, I don't know, if he doesn't mention specifically Gula here, but he's talking about the improvement of the state of the Jewish people. Alkali was, he wrote this in 1843. This was after the Damascus affair, where anti-Semitism was spurned anew. And he's saying, how do we improve the state of the Jewish people? We got to find 22,000 volunteers to go and live and set up a colony in Eretz Israel, because that's the only way we'll fulfill this Gemara. Neid ani alai shekol yamai. And this is, think about the things that he's predicting now are fascinating. I would like to give witness. I would like to attest to the fact. Shekol yamai, we're in the second paragraph in source one. Nitzta'arti al davar zeh velo tov asu avotenu shekol kach ishkichu et lishonenu hakdosha. All of my life, writing in 1843, right? This is 50 years before Herzl, even thought about Zionism, right? In all of my life, I've always lamented the fact that our forefathers allowed the Jewish language, the holy tongue, Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew, to slip away. And we allowed, I mean, he's writing, it's a little unfair historically, he's writing as if we chose to spread out into 70 nations. We know that that is not the case. But he's basically pointing a finger at our forefathers, saying, and we decided to spread out into 70 different nations. El kol ha'makomot asher nafutzubam, and all these different places that they went. Vetzarech kama yamim mishanim ad shehayal yodeh letargem et haTorah. His subject here is the Hebrew language. And we are so foreign, the Hebrew language is so foreign for us now, that we have to spend years and years and years, backbreaking effort, just so that our children can understand the Pasuk in Chumash. Does that sound familiar to any of us? Anybody who's raised children? All right, forgive me, Zachary. Yeah?
This is the Alkali of the dictionary?
No.
That's not.
Different person.
Then it's a coincidence because he speaks about the language.
I'm assuming that the dictionary Alkali is a descendant of his. I something in my head says that I knew that at one point, but this is not him.
Because it's a coincidence.
Yeah.
He's talking about language.
Right. Vishanim. All right. It's okay. Valpi. We're in the last paragraph of source one. Valpi ateva. All right. Now the question is, he's taking a very Kabbalistic bend. Valpi ateva kimach shehi davar nimna ubatel shaloshonenu akdosha tashuv lemechuna. It is a impossibility. It is not possible for in a natural way for our lashon hakodesh to return to our people. All right. We all know how wrong he was. Aval kevan shiyad anavi ol. Right, next sentence. Right, we're in the bold here. The Navi, Yoel was giving a prophecy that eventually the Hebrew tongue, Hebrew language is going to return to us. We shouldn't give up. What is Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai calling for in 1843? Not only for a colony of 22,000 people to make sure that the God smiles kindly on the Jewish people and improves our standing. The Jewish language needs to be revived. And even though it's something that is supernatural, he actually says impossible. We have a guarantee from the Navi of, from Yoel HaNavi that if we do it, eventually it'll happen. So, how prescient were his words? I wanted to mention the next source, not because of its significance, but to his Zionism, but because, again, just how prescient he was in the years leading up to leading up to the 20th century. So, we're in source number two. Well, you'll see what I mean in a second. They have to make this ingathering into Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the sixth millennium. All right, so it was in 1843 in the year. When was... All right, so we have to do this soon. All right, because what's going to happen? This is a very popular concept in the Zoharic literature, right? That there was that the galut was set up based on millenniums. Since at the time, in the year 5000, right, that's what he's talking about, we should have gone in the year 5000. Since we didn't go in the year 5000 corresponds to the year 1240. Right? So, which, by the way, we didn't get into it, but there was a big connection to messianic movements in the year 1240 for this reason. So they should have gone in the year 1240. They didn't. The Kevan Shloitaru Yisrael El Kibbutz Hazeh Itchilu Atzarot Amarot Haraot VaGirush Mashmadot. So it's not entirely true, but right, 1096 was the Crusades. That was pretty lousy for the Jewish people. But again, we're going to forgive him his historical inaccuracies. He understands that for Kabbalistic reasons, we were supposed to start our Kibbutz Galiot in the year 1240. Since we didn't, that's when all the trouble for the Jewish people started. Zeh Shekosov Rabbi Yehuda Beperechelek. The Masech and Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yehuda says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ma'amit Lahem Melech Shegzirotav Kashot Kahaman U'machziran Lamotav. What's going to happen? How are we going to rectify the fact that this historical mistake of not doing what we should have done in the year 1240? We need to, like the Gemara in Perichelek says, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, what Hashem is going to do to rectify it is that He's going to appoint bad, bad people over us, and they're going to make worse gezerot even than Haman. And eventually we're going to improve because of that. Ratzal Omar, Yim lo yasu tshuva la'eretz Yisrael, right, we're on page 2 now, if we don't return to our homeland, HaKadosh Baruch Hu ma'amid lahem melech, He's going to appoint a king, Shegzerotav kashot v'ra'ot, whose laws are going to be very, very bad for us. Machziron bal korcham shelo b'tovotam, and eventually we're going to return against our will and not on our own terms. Shegzerot shelo b'tovotam ki biyad chazaka yishalchem uviyad chazaka yigarshem merzo beirum uvechoser kol kmo sheira lavotena migarshes svarad domain. So, all right, he's speaking in general terms. I don't think that this was any prophecy for foreseeing the Holocaust. I mean, there are people that would interpret it that way. I'm a little bit more of a rationalist, and I would say he in the year 1840 he saw these pogroms that were happening as a result of this ridiculous blood libel, and across the Jewish world, stretching all the way to Western Europe, and he said, "We are not safe here." And I'm seeing this as a fulfillment of this Gemara in the Masechet Sanhedrin, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for not fulfilling the historical obligation that we had in the year 1240 to make Aliyah, for everybody to go, bad things are happening and they're going to continue to happen. Whether he had Hitler himself in mind, which, you know, this is in 1843. So, this is 100 years. And he talks about the century, how we need to do this in the next century. So whether he had Hitler in mind, or whether he was just talking about general anti-Semitism, which we know was rampant in Europe during these decades, which is what one of the things that gave birth to the Chivat Zion movement. I don't know. But again, I think that how prescient Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai was for the need for Chivat Zion was just really a very significant thing too. So I wanted to put that out there. Okay. A contemporary of Yehuda Alkalai was Rav Sirish Kalischer. Has anybody ever heard of him?
I was in shul the other night, and I was preparing, and I had my Drishat Zion, which was a book. I mean, Mossad Rav Kook republished it recently, and some people asked me what I was reading.
Eli actually got up and said, "Oh, good, you're saying Gemara Torah." I said, "No, I'm just exhausted, and I was wanting to lean on the Shtender." So I said, "We're going to talk a little bit about Ratzfir Kalischer when we come this morning. So Eli, I'm fulfilling my end of the bargain here. So Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was he? So he was born in Lisa. Anybody hear of somebody named Rav Yaakov Milisa? Rav Yaakov Milisa wrote a very, very important, very famous work, critical of the Ketzot HaChoshen. Anybody know what it's called? It's called the Tivot HaMishpat. So Rav Yaakov Milisa was the Rebbe of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, in every sense of the word, was a gadol b'Torah. He was a master of learning. He was a prolific writer, right? And he was born, and he was a student of Rav Yaakov Milisa, and the other personality who's probably a little more well known was Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Those were his two rabbanim. And so we're talking about some pretty significant rabbinic stock here. He married and he moved to Thorn, in what's now northern Poland. Again, I refer you to the map to see where I'm talking about. And he served as an acting rabbi for 40 years. In the spirit of the Chafetz Chaim, who came a few decades after he died, he was not a rabbi for hire. He served as the acting rabbi in the community. There was a German term for it that I saw, a Polish term for it that I saw, but I couldn't pronounce it anyway, so I translated acting rabbi for you. His role there was to be the rabbinic leader, but he never got paid for it, because his wife ran a business for him. He conceived, Rav Hirsch Kalischer conceived, very similar. He saw the stuff that was going on in 1840, but he's in a completely different part of the world. You see where... you saw where Alkali was. Kalischer is in Europe, right? And he saw the pogroms and the anti-Semitism that was raging after the Damascus Affair in 1840. And he began a very intense campaign arguing for the importance of Shivat Zion. Now, what he did that Alkali did not do is, instead of just theorizing, he made real plans. He went around, he campaigned. And he had this plan. He was, again, very much a rabbinic leader. And he had this plan not only to move en masse back to Eretz Yisrael, but to reestablish the halachic life in Eretz Yisrael. And one of the things that he does is, and he writes this book, Drishat Zion, in which he originally was meant as a speech that he was going to give to Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who was from the famous Rothschild banking family, right? His idea was basically, let's get the Rothschilds to pull their money together and buy Palestine from the Ottoman Empire, which was a very practical idea. He wasn't just saying, let's all get up and move. Who cares what obstacles come up? Let me talk to the richest, most famous, most well known Jew of the in the world, and let's get him to finance the project. So he goes about writing this whole book, which is meant as an argument to Rothschild, and in this version, the Mossad Arkuk version, they actually have here a letter that he writes. Right? This is a photo, a facsimile of the letter that he's writing to Edmund de Rothschild, arguing for this system. So, in addition to the political plans of establishing, planning mass movements, buying land, buying tracts of land. He also makes arguments for the halachic restoration of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, and even without a mikdash, he argues for the reinstitution of karbanot on Har HaBayit. Once we own the land and once we can establish it as our own territory, we can reinstitute karbanot. We can reinstitute the mitzvot atliyot baaretz. So what sets Kalischer apart is that he not only theorized about these things, he not only wrote about them, but he was politically very active. He pursued the plan with every fiber of his being. So I have one quote from here, from Drishat Zion. I got from a couple of different places. Gulat Yisrael, we're in source number 3. Asher anachnu hokimla, the redemption the redemption of the land of the Jewish people that we are waiting for. Ayach shov ki pitom yarad Hashem yitbarach mishamayim baretz. Don't think that this is something that Hashem is just going to perform, on the snap of a finger, right? And stark contrast to Alkali, who was saying all we need to do is move 22,000 people there, and then. Again, he doesn't mention Gula, but it sounds like that's what he's talking about. So don't think that it's going to happen by ways of supernatural means. Lomar la'amotzu, we're in the third line. O yishlach mishicho karega, or he's going to send Mashiach in an instant, min ha'shamayim, down from the heavens, litkoa b'shofar gadol, al nitchei Yisrael, Vikatzen Yerushalayim, that he's going to come and he's going to send Mashiach down from the heavens. He's going to blow his shofar and everybody's going to start flocking to Yerushalayim. Vayase lechomat esh, he's going to make a great wall of fire. Umikdash el merorim tered, right? Which is, this is a little bit of a cynical tone, but this, he's talking to a very prevalent ideology that existed in, it still exists to a large extent today. That the redemption is supposed to come of supernatural means. We're not allowed to take part in it. It's something that needs to just take its natural course or take its divine course. He's saying it's not going to happen. Kasher yiftiach al yedei avadav ha-neviim lo ken korei maskil. He's saying the things that the Nevi'im explicitly said, and I can't stress this enough. This is not, we're going to talk about some very heretical Jews that were they're theorists of Zionism. This guy was a Gadol Batorah, a renowned, prolific author. He wrote Chidushim on Shas, he wrote Chidushim on Shulchan Aruch. He was a renowned halachic authority. And he's writing here, don't think that what the Nevi'im said about Shivat Zion, about the return to Eretz Yisrael, is actually what's literally going to happen. There are centuries, there's an opinion in the Baalei HaTosafot that the third Beit HaMikdash, I'm sure many of us have heard of this, the third Beit HaMikdash is going to come in Hashemayim, which I always like picture. There's somewhere in heaven, there's a big, fully formed building, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to flip a switch, and like, that's going to, you know, crush the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know. I don't advocate crushing the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but that's always how I conceived of it. And there's a long history of these opinions. Kalischer is coming along and saying, no. That's not how it's going to happen. All right, we're in midway through the first paragraph. Vadai kol Yehudei Neviim yitkaimu ba'achri taimit. Definitely, what the Neviim say, those things are going to happen. V'lo b'munusan elech, v'lo b'chipazon yom echad. But we're not going to do it. You know, at the drop of a hat, we're not going to do it so quickly. Ki im me'at ne'at tavo geulat Yisrael, the redemption of the Jewish people is going to happen in a very slow and gradual process. Again, writing in 1862, we're talking here. La'at la'at tatzmiach keren Yeshua. Slowly, slowly but surely, the seeds of our redemption are going to be laid. All right. Zot ha'itza yutza. I skipped to much later in the book. This is what I suggest. Chevrat Yishuv Eretz Yisrael tatzmiach la'akim shama nachalat sadav ha'kerem. We need to, I think he's speaking both literally and figuratively here, we need to plant seeds in the Chevrat Yisrael, the Jewish community, needs to plant seeds in the land of Israel. And that's how we're going to get there, and that's how we're going to cure this immense famine, this immense tragedy of Jewish history. There's going to be people outside, and there's going to be people that are going to join in. But the point is that what we need to do now, all right? And this is what Kalischer is advocating for. And again, I could have put, I should have given everybody homework to read this entire book. You should. But what he's suggesting here is that even though we're not going to see its fruition in our lifetime, we need to lay the seeds. We need to start working towards it because it's going to be a slow and gradual process. Now, this was, for somebody of this stature, to say something like this is a very, very significant thing. And again, look at the years. It's 1862. The Dreyfus Affair doesn't happen until 1894. Herzl doesn't write Der Judenstaat until 1895. It doesn't get published until February of 1896. So we are 35 years before anybody's ever heard of somebody named Theodor Herzl. And he's talking pretty much about what Herzl says, right? Some of this could have come right out of Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, Herzl's monograph that he famously announced this plan. So again, we can't talk about Herzl as coming out of nowhere. Look at the forerunners. Look at the people that existed in the decades before him. And mind you, I would argue, look at how significant it is that this is before assimilation was as rampant as it eventually became in the latter half of the 19th century. These were traditional, profoundly religious Jews, religious leaders. And they were advocating a very similar program to Herzl. Okay, let's take a look at now somebody a little bit later, and somebody we're going to get to, our first non-traditional Jew. Yeah?
How is this perceived by the general population?
So by and large, most people laughed at them. Right? Yeah. This is what made this so unique. It's what made them such visionaries. It's because they were looking at practical... Herzl was laughed at also. All right. If Herzl wasn't laughed at, right? Yes, we'll get to Herzl in a little bit. But the Zionist Congress was convened, and you know, there were 200 at the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897. There were 200 people that were there, and there were representatives from all over the world. If his ideas were better received, then there could have been not 2,000. There could have been 20,000 people there. This was a new idea. Look, as cultural revolutions happen slowly, right? I've mentioned him a lot of times. But he's one of my, I've never really studied with him, but I've heard and read a lot of his. Dr. Soloveitchik likes to talk a lot about cultural revolutions. He worked with the Balei HaTosafot, who were a cultural revolution in the 12th century. Cultural revolutions take a long time. Is that the way he puts it, I think it usually takes about 100 years for a cultural revolution to really take hold. So maybe that's what we're talking about here. If he's the Alkali and Kalisha, they're talking about 100 years before Hakamat HaMedina. So maybe that's really what's, maybe Dr. Soloveitchik is on the money here. And that's this really took a long time once the seeds were laid. But to answer your question, not great.
I'm assuming Rothschild said no.
Yes, Rothschild was funding, was already funding settlements in the land of Israel. We're going to get to that in a minute. But he, this idea of immigration en masse, of buying huge tracts of land, never mind the fact that he would have to basically use his entire fortune to do it, but... he saw it as impractical. He didn't think that it was something that was feasible, which is a theme that we'll see. But I think, again, Medinat Yisrael was not born out of Kalisher, but I think that the effort that he was making was so significant, and particularly in the decades before Herzl, we shouldn't make note of it. Okay, Moses Hess. Moses Hess was the first assimilated Jew who was really coming from Western Europe that we're going to see. He was a contemporary and friend of Karl Marx. Any political theorists here, does anybody care about the history of communism? The Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx, mentions Moses Hess. Right? Moses Hess was an ardent Zionist. Now, that if you want to talk about one of the most important books ever written, all right, the Communist Manifesto is up there. And it actually mentions Moses Hess. It derived Moses Hess because Karl Marx in the end broke away from him. But for a time, they were the comrades, and they were chavrusas in terms of political theory. So the idea of socialism in being the political movement that was going to give birth to the state, which again couldn't be more prescient, it was exactly what happened. That was one of the first people to really articulate that message as Moses Hess. He was born in Bonn, which now Western Germany. It was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, I think. I'm pretty sure. He was a contemporary and friend of Karl Marx, and he was an early theorist of communism and socialism. Again, he was completely assimilated. Right, he was even intermarried. He witnessed anti-Semitism rising in Germany. Again, the Damascus affair set off a wave that was going on for decades. And even though he had completely left tradition, he reasserted his Jewish identity and published this book called Rome and Jerusalem. Right, so we're not going to read through the whole thing, but let's just skip to the bullet. Right, so we're in the second paragraph. Again, I've been doing this through the whole series. I put more here than we have time to read. I encourage everybody to take the sheets home and to read it to yourselves. Second paragraph of source number 4 on page 2. 20 years ago, when news came to Europe from Damascus of an absurd accusation against the Jews, again, Damascus affair coming up, a feeling of agony, as bitter as it was justified, was evoked in the hearts of all Jews. Once again, we were face to face with the ignorance and credulity of the mobs of Asia and Europe, which are as ready today as they have been for the past 2,000 years to believe any calumny directed against the Jews. Okay? So he's citing the anti-Semitism on the rise. Remember we spoke about the disputation of 1263 with Pablo Christianity of the Ramban, the Aliyah of Rabbi Chilmi Paris after the 1240 disputation with Nicholas Donin. Usually what lights the fire under people to theorize about the Shivat Zion is lousy conditions, lousy events, unfortunate occurrences that take place in Galut, where we are a minority population. Same thing happened with Alkali and Kalisher. They were looking at the same historical events, the rise of anti-Semitism. Moses Hess was doing the same thing. We're on the next bold in the top of page 3. The rigid forms of orthodoxy, the existence of which was justified before the century of rebirth, he's talking about the Enlightenment here, will naturally, through the productive power of the national idea and historical cult, relax and become fertile. Basically saying religion is going to go by the wayside. It is only with the national rebirth that the religious genius of the Jews, like the giant of legend touching Mother Earth, will be endowed with new strength and again be re-inspired with the prophetic spirit. So he sees, as many of the acculturated, assimilated Jews did, he sees Jewish enlightenment as being this new form of prophecy, this new form of divine inspiration. All right, next paragraph. What we have to do at present for the regeneration of the Jewish nation is, first, to keep alive the hope of the political rebirth of our people, and next, to reawaken that hope where it slumbers. So we need to, how do we cure anti-Semitism? How do we cure this? We need to foster this notion of political rebirth. Right, next paragraph, from the top of the next paragraph. A great calling is reserved for you, to be a living channel of communication between three continents. You should be the bearers of civilization. This is a book that he's writing, right? He's writing it for the Jewish nation, for everybody to read. You should be the bearers of civilization to the primitive people of Asia, and the teachers of the European sciences to which your race has contributed so much. And in Roman Jerusalem, he goes on to say, how are we going to do that? By establishing our own polity in our ancestral homeland, and in doing so, becoming completely independent. And that's the only way, once we're an independent political power, that this enlightened, superior intellect of the Jew is going to be able to have an effect on the rest of the world. Moses Hess was saying this, again, look at the year that this was published. This is 1862. We're still 30 years before, or in reaction to the anti-Semitism after the Damascus affair, and we're still over 30 years before Herzl comes along. Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's heard of him? What do we know about Eliezer ben Yehuda? What do you know about him? Eliezer ben Yehuda is, I would argue Eliezer ben Yehuda is probably, he's up there and he's one of the least well known. He's probably one of the most significant figures in the history of the modern day Yeshuv and Eretz Yisrael. And I think he's up there with Herzl, he's up there with Ben-Gurion, he's up there with Nachum Begin, he's up there with everybody that had a role in Medinat Yisrael. Because the character that Medinat Yisrael has today, the character that Medinat Yisrael was able to have in 1948 with the Hakamat HaMedina, never could have happened without the revival of the Hebrew language, which is a miracle. And I can't ever stop and just sit and appreciate, try and think about what a miracle it is that a language that hadn't been used in 2,500 years, 2,500 years, suddenly became a spoken language. Like, I stubbed my foot. Oh my God. Oy vey. Alright. Yesh li ka'ev ba'regel sheli. Like, that was that became a reality. That is, we read like ancient Ugaritic or hieroglyphics in Egypt. Can you imagine that language coming up again? Because it's ludicrous. Because that's how ridiculous the idea of reigniting the Jewish language was. And it happened. And Eliezer ben Yehuda is probably, if there's one figure, he's probably the one that is most responsible for it.
Can I just clarify? Yeah. I agree with you, what you just said about Eliezer ben Yehuda. Was part of it because there were those who felt it was asur to discuss everyday matters?
Well, that's the difference.
You want my honest opinion? Forgive the cynicism, but usually people come up with, people like to justify things that they don't want to be engaged in. So I think people saw themselves not speaking Hebrew. They recognized that Hebrew was a language that was long gone. We already have a Jewish language that identifies us culturally. I know, by the way, I'm not a hater of Yiddish. Eliezer ben Yehuda was a hater of Yiddish and Ladino, but I am not. So I think people, you know, you justify the way things are for those reasons. That's my cynical take. Do I think that there's something to it? Probably, but I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe I've spoken that.
It was a written language, so I guess it's not as crazy as hieroglyphics becoming a because the language was still around. But the idea of it becoming a spoken language was really that ridiculous.
And the equivalent would bring Latin back.
Yeah, bring Latin back bring Elizabethan Shakespearean English back as a spoken language.
It's not.
How about that? Wherefore art thou to go to the bathroom today, Elliot? That would be talking that way. Maybe that would be a good comparison. All right. Be that as it may. So Eliezer ben Yehuda, he's born in Western Europe. Oh no, he's in Belarus, so he's more in Eastern Europe. But he has a traditional Jewish education. You'll see that there's a sprinkling of people who grew up completely assimilated like Herzl, and lots of people who grew up very traditional. So Eliezer ben Yehuda had a very traditional upbringing, and then eventually he moves on and becomes very active in Chovevei Tzion and leaves religion, as did many in the 19th century. And the idea that he has in his head is the importance of the revival of the Hebrew language. He detests, he despises Yiddish. Yiddish, he says, is the ghetto language. And if we want to revive the culture and the spirit of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, we need to have our actual language, not this Mamzer language that we invented in Galut, but our actual ancestral language, which, by the way, we have the means to recreate. So Eliezer ben Yehuda goes on to write how many volumes are there of his dictionary? A lot of them. 7 or 8. In his lifetime, I think he published 5 of them. He goes on, it's his life's work. He goes on to publish a dictionary of the modern Hebrew language while living in Eretz Yisrael. Now, fascinating story. Eliezer ben Yehuda has a son, and apparently he was a little bit abusive to his wife about this. He would not allow any language but Hebrew spoken in his home. Because to him, the only way that we're going to achieve redemption, the only way that we're going to achieve Shivat Zion is if we revive the Hebrew language. How are we going to do that? By only speaking Hebrew in our home. So there's a story that Eliezer ben Yehuda physically reprimanded his wife after she spoke to him, and you know, she reprimanded their son in Yiddish or whatever language. So Eliezer ben Yehuda was pretty hardcore about this language. But as a result, his son was the first person in how long? 2,500 years to grow up with Hebrew as their native tongue. Fascinating. And it spread like wildfire. In the decades that followed, with the main immigrations on the Aliyot from Eastern Europe, it was a big part of it. It was a big, 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 big part of it. The culture, I would argue that the culture that led to Hakamat HaMedina, like I said, could not have happened without the seeds that were laid by Eliezer ben Yehuda in the revival of the Hebrew language. Okay. He wasn't a big writer other than his dictionary. But he did. He wrote a lot in magazines. He wrote a lot in Jewish periodicals. So this is a letter to Peretz Smolenskin, who was in and of himself an important Sioni. I didn't put anything from him here, but he wrote. Smolenskin wrote, and he was the editor of a Jewish newspaper called Hashachar. So this is a letter that he wrote to him in 1880 in response to a letter that he wrote to him. For if we may indeed still hope for redemption, if we have not yet despaired of becoming a living nation. By the way, this is a title page of Eliezer ben Yehuda's dictionary. Underneath the picture. Our thinking must be guided by the vision of what this people will become once its renaissance is achieved. Now, he's living in 1880. The Aliyot are for the first time really starting. There's starting mass immigration to Eretz Yisrael. And now, what's going to become of this? The only way that we're going to do this is to lay the proper seeds for a Jewish culture in the land. Today we may be moribund, but tomorrow we will surely awaken to life. Today we may be in a strange land, but tomorrow we will dwell in the land of our fathers. Today we may be speaking alien tongues, but tomorrow we shall speak Hebrew. This is the meaning of the hope of the redemption, and I know no other. Our hope is for redemption, in its clear and literal sense, not for some veiled and over-subtle substitute. So Eliezer ben Yehuda sees the Hebrew language, Safa Ivrit, as the center, as the pinnacle, as the focal point from which Shivat Zion, from which redemption, from which the Kibbutz Galiot can grow from. If we don't achieve a Jewish culture, which is reminiscent of Achad Ha'am, which we'll see hopefully in a couple of minutes. If we don't achieve a Jewish culture, then there's going to be nothing for everybody to come back to. We need to lay the seeds. And that's why we need to revive the Hebrew language. And his life's work, you know, really gave birth to a culture in Eretz Yisrael. One of the, it's funny, I didn't put it here, but one of Smolenskin's arguments is that Hebrew is a dead language. And there's no way that we can ever do science, no way we can ever do academia in Hebrew. How can we do it? The only thing that we can read in Hebrew are like, you know, Chidushim of the, Chidushim of the Ketos HaChoshen on Shulchan Aruch. That's what we can read in Hebrew. But we can't do history, we can't do science, we can't do physics, we can't do, right? So how wrong Smolenskin was, how right Ben Yehuda was. All right, and of course he is immortalized in Eretz Yisrael today, in Medina Yisrael, by the naming of one of the most popular tourist locales, you know, after him. Right? If anybody wants to buy kippot or get ripped off for particular, you know, different types of souvenirs, everybody knows that Eliezer ben Yehuda is the person that we have to thank for for that tourist center. Okay, so now, okay, so we spoke in, I've 80% of our discussion today, we've now spent before we've even gotten to Herzl. Now I'd like to get to Herzl. So I think that while I think it's really significant and central to the discussion of Tzionut, to realize where Herzl was coming from, and to realize that Tzionut and Shivat Zion, Chivat Zion, is a millennia-old passion of the Jewish people, I do think it's important to realize what contribution Herzl did make. And while I think that some of the lesser-known players in the early years of the Medina were probably less appreciated than they should have been, Herzl was rightly appreciated. What did he do? So Herzl, unlike many of the names that we've seen before, that we've seen up until now, Herzl grew up in a completely secular home. All right, like I said, his father was the son of a traditional Jew, but was completely assimilated. And by the time he had children, they no longer, religion was not a part of his life. I don't even know, I have never read any full-length biographies of Herzl, but I don't even know if he could read Hebrew. He had a bar mitzvah of some kind, and we know that Herzl's grandfather Right? Remember him, Shimon Leib Herzl, who was a student of Alkali, a congregant of Alkali in Semlin. So he came to Herzl's bar mitzvah. So they grew up in Budapest, and eventually he moves to Vienna. And while he's in Vienna, he gets educated. He becomes a lawyer. Failed legal career, and he really is much more of a poet. He's much more of a writer and a thinker. And he ends up earning a living as a journalist, but with the real passion of his, which was to be a playwright. And he wrote plays. He wrote stories. So none of this is particularly Jewish culturally. Most there are actually historians that look at Herzl's life. There's very little Jewish-themed writing that goes on in the early part of his life. Now he dies very young, right? He dies at 44. So early part of his life is all relative. But in the lead up to his Zionist activity, there's very little Jewish identity that he has. But he's a journalist. He's the main foreign correspondent for the main paper in Vienna. And he's now the foreign correspondent in Paris, where he is working as a playwright as well. And while he's there, he covers the trial of Alfred Dreyfus. It became in posterity known as the Dreyfus Affair. I'm assuming many of us have heard of the Dreyfus Affair. Nods, yes, okay. So the Dreyfus Affair, what was the Dreyfus Affair? Alfred Dreyfus, in 1894, was accused. Basically, the French army got wind of the fact that there was somebody who was selling secrets to the Germans, right? French military secrets. And if you think about the history of this, this is 20 years before World War I, so the seeds were brewing here. People were not getting along very well. So French army gets wind of the fact that somebody's selling secrets to the German government, and somebody points a finger and says it's Dreyfus. And what happens is Dreyfus, like Herzl, is a completely secularized, assimilated Jew. And what happens is this huge awakening of anti-Semitism. And everybody is very, very quick to believe that Dreyfus was in fact guilty, when the preponderance of evidence showed that he was not. And in a kangaroo court in 1894, they convict him. And what happens, what stems from this, is this huge wave of anti-Semitism where people start to scream death to the Jews in the street, thinking that the greatest threat that we have to our country today is the presence of the Jewish minority, who bands together, they don't marry out, and they have world domination in mind, and they just want to undermine everybody, so we need to do something about that. And he sees this uproar of anti-Semitism, and what it inspires him to the philosophy that many decades earlier, 100 years, centuries earlier, what came to, that the real cure to anti-Semitism, to Jewish persecution in Europe, is reestablishment of the Jewish political independence. And that's where he gets obsessed with this. The other latter-day historians like to emphasize less the Dreyfus Affair and emphasize more the rise of a politician in... what's it called? Where was it? Right, the rise of a politician in Vienna, of this guy Karl Luger. Anybody hear of Karl Luger? Karl Luger was Hitler's Rebbe for anti-Semitism. So, and if you think about it, he came to power in 1895. Der Judenstaat was written in 1895. So he was a very vocal anti-Semite. So I would say that definitely he was intimately involved in the Dreyfus Affair. He was a native Viennese citizen, so he knew about Luger. So he starts getting this idea that we need to have Jewish political independence. And he writes Der Judenstaat. He starts writing in 1895. He writes it very quickly. And he lays out in Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, the state of the Jews, however you translate it, he starts outlining his political philosophy for how we're going to achieve political independence. Now, what sets Herzl apart, which is what I need to emphasize, what sets Herzl apart from people before him, similar to Kalischer, but on a much more expansive level, is that he rallies the Jewish people. He rallies the Jewish communities around Europe in support of this idea. And he also is a very savvy political theorist. And he knows that the only way that we can do this in a smooth way is to have, before we can start moving en masse, we need to have the acknowledgement and we need to have the agreement of foreign powers. If we don't have the agreement of foreign powers, if we don't have the diplomacy necessary for a Jewish state, then we'll never have a Jewish state. And all of the immigration that we can muster is not going to have a good effect. So he does two things. He convenes the Zionist Congress, which was an internal, right? And he starts the World Zionist Organization, which was an internal organization whose goal was to promote Jewish settlement and rebirth of the Jewish political independence in the land of Israel. And he also spends the last 8 years of his life in between the Zionist Congresses traveling around the world trying to get foreign recognition of the Zionist Charter, of his idea of resettling the Jewish people and with political independence in their ancestral homeland. He lives through six Zionist congresses, right? At the, and he dies of heart failure. He ran himself into a shmata for all the years that he was running around because he was obsessed with this idea. So very quickly, because we're almost out of time. His first entry, number six, take a look at it on your own. This is the first mention that we have where he gets the idea of Jewish state. So a couple of excerpts from Der Judenstaat. We're on source number seven. Let's just read the bullets. Restoration of the Jewish state. The materials for the structure I here sketch exist in reality. They are quite tangible. This anyone can establish to his own satisfaction. Right? So we need to resolve the problems of the Jews with the seeds that have already been laid. Think about the seeds that Alkali and Kalisha were talking about. Think about the seeds that Ben Yehuda was talking about. Those who today inaugurate this movement or in the next bold are unlikely to live to see its glorious culmination. But the very inauguration is enough to inspire in them a high pride and joy of an inner liberation of their existence. Right? This is, of course, originally in German. Anti-Semitism, we're in the fourth paragraph, in the bold. Anti-Semitism is a highly complex movement, which I think I understand. I approach this movement as a Jew, yet without fear or hatred. I believe that I can see in it the elements of cruel sport, of common defense, of common commercial rivalry, of inherited prejudice or religious intolerance, but also of a supposed need for self-defense. Right? So listen to these terms that he's using. The importance of natural prejudice that leads to anti-Semitism, the importance for self-defense. Right? The next bullet. We have sincerely tried everywhere to merge with the national communities in which we live, seeking only to preserve the faith of our fathers. It is not permitted to us. We've tried to blend in. We've labored intensely. Think, this is Herzl talking. Herzl didn't have a lick of Yiddishkeit to him. And he felt that he was being labeled and discriminated against as a Jew. Right, the next bold. The majority decide who the alien is. This and all else in the relations between peoples is a matter of power. This is how anti-Semitism works. Right, the next paragraph. No one can deny the gravity of the Jewish situation. Wherever they live in appreciable number, Jews are persecuted in greater or lesser measure. Their equality before the law, granted by stature, has become practically a dead letter. Jews will never be equal. Next bold, right? Third to last paragraph on page 5. The whole plan is essentially quite simple, as it must necessarily be if it is to be comprehensible at all. Let sovereignty be granted us over a portion of the globe adequate to meet our rightful national requirements. We will attend to the rest. Just give us some land, and we will handle everything else. To create a new state is neither ridiculous nor impossible. The governments of all countries scourged by anti-Semitism will be keenly interested in obtaining sovereignty for us. Right? Everybody doesn't like the Jews. So what's our best selling point? If you don't like the Jews, let's set up a Jewish state and you can get rid of them and they'll all leave. Right? That's his argument. You think the Jews are a poison to your community, to your country? Let's set up a state. Acknowledge my state. And this is a pretty good selling point. He ultimately is unsuccessful and he's not able to get any real recognition. But the efforts that he made really laid the seeds for a lot of the political developments that happened in the decades that followed. To create a new state, isn't it, right? We did that one. Right, second to last bold. We must not visualize the exodus of the Jews as a sudden one. It will be gradual, proceeding over a period of decades. Think about how prophetic this is. It is silly to revert to older levels of civilization, as other Zionists propose. We shall build a bolder and more stately style than has ever been done before. He's referring to the early Aliyot that had happened in the late 19th century, where people were setting up small little pockets of communities that were funded by foreign, you know, wealthy Jews. This is the type of thing that Rothschild was engaged in, that Kalischer did not want to, they didn't want to take Kalischer's idea. All right, last paragraph. Palestine is our unforgettable historic homeland. The very name would be a marvelously effective rallying cry. If His Majesty the Sultan, talking about the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, were to give us Palestine, we could in return undertake the complete management of the finances of Turkey. We should there form a part of a wall of defense for Europe and Asia, an outpost of civilization against barbarism. We should, as a neutral state, remain in contact with all of Europe, which would have to guarantee our existence. Does this sound like Netanyahu to you? I mean, it really does. He's getting up and talking about how we're going to be the front lines for barbarism. We're going to be a light. We're going to be a model for economic and agricultural and technological growth. That's who we're going to be. Okay. Achad Ha'am is another very significant, theorist. We're not going to read him inside. I think we'll, in terms of reading everybody inside, we'll stop with this. So let me just go through who else I have. Achad Ha'am, that was his pen name. It was the name that he changed it to. It was really Asher Tzvi Ginzburg. Right, so he was born in Skvera. Right, now he's in central Ukraine. Again, I refer you to the map. Achad Ha'am is significant because he was somebody that argued incessantly with Herzl. He was a contemporary of his. He was present at the first Zionist Congress. And he thinks that this idea of political rebirth of the Jewish people is a complete impossibility. He thinks there's no way to do it. You're going to waste our time. And not only that, you're going to give this a new hope to a generation of Jews, and they're going to fail. And then what's going to happen? So he's not wrong, because Herzl's plan of getting international recognition and being the financiers of the Ottoman Empire and ingratiating ourselves to everybody ultimately was a failure. So Achad Ha'am is not wrong. But what he advocated instead, and again, I urge you to read this when you get a chance, what he advocated instead was a different model for Zionism. He said that Jewish settlement, as it is, little pockets of settlements need to continue, because Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael needs to exist as the model for the Jewish people, the model for the spiritual center. And it's funny, because he was a completely assimilated Jew, but in the Western enlightened sense, he thought that his new enlightened version of Judaism was divine, to the extent that, you know, something can be divine for a secular Jew. And he said that Herzl, they're faithless, godless, religionless people, the people who are in charge of the World Zionist Organization. How could we establish a state that's supposed to be a Jewish state without the heart and soul of Judaism? Now, he and us would probably disagree about what the heart and soul of Judaism is. But what Achad Ha'am theorized, which I think is also another very, very much an aspect of Eretz Yisrael today, is the notion of Eretz Yisrael as a spiritual center for Am Yisrael. And in the Hakamat HaMedina, in the years leading up to the Hakamat HaMedina, this is a big part of why the Hebrew University was founded. There was this thought, Gershom Shalom was an early proponent of this. There was this thought that if we're going to have, you know, a Jewish independent political structure, we need to be the center of Jewish studies. We need to be the center of Judaism. And for Western Europeans, for enlightened Europeans, that meant Wissenschaft, that meant the science of Judaism. For the more traditional, that meant establishing yeshivot. But what Achad Ha'am contributed was also a very significant part of the soul of Medina Yisrael that exists today. The importance, the significance of Eretz Yisrael not being only the political center of Judaism, but being the spiritual center of Judaism as well. So, Achad Ha'am, I encourage you to read this stuff. By the way, if anybody has never seen this, Arthur Hertzberg has an edited, this is good for until about 1950. This is a lot of primary sources, all translated into English. Very, very important text for studying the history of Zionism. So a lot of the primary texts that I couldn't find in other languages I got from here. Okay, so Rav Kook is another person. Again, if you want to talk about the spiritual center, but also about the importance of the political revival and how the holistic spiritual existence of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Kook is your man. I have a few quotes from him. I put a little bit of something from Ben Gurion here, who was a theorist in his own right, but his strength, Ben Gurion, was probably less as a political theorist and more as a politician. He was a tireless advocate for independence of the Jewish people in Am Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael, and of course he was a military commander as well. He led the Jewish people. He led the Medina through its early years, both politically, economically, and in terms of the Aliyot. And then I put a couple of things from the Rav here. We can't have a discussion about Tzionut and certainly religious Zionism without some discussion of Rav Soloveitchik, who of course colors so much of our ideology in terms of the land of Israel. I would just point out, this is also something that before I appreciated what the Rav contributed to Maseches Bava Kamma and Maseches Brachos, my father very much emphasized to me how important it is to realize how revolutionary the Rav was. The Rav was coming from a family that was not Tzioni. Very much the opposite. There was a long-standing tradition of being against any form of reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. Right? And that was, and part of it was reactionary because this was a movement that was led by non-religious Jews, which is a debate that we have that's ongoing to today. if we had 5 shiurim on modern political Zionism, we would talk extensively about religious Zionism in the debate, but we don't. Rav Soloveitchik, despite that immense family tradition, of which the Rav was not a rebel. The Rav revered his father, we all know, to no end. And he revered his grandfather to no end. Not just halachically, but ideologically as well. All you need to do is read through the stories in Ish Halacha to see that. And despite that, the Rav felt that the immense historical responsibility of supporting Medinat Yisrael, despite all of that family history. So we can't have any discussion without at least mentioning his name. I don't think that we did justice to any of the figures here. Again, we could have spent hours on each one of them. But again, what I try to convey today is the importance of recognizing, on the one hand, the forerunners to Herzl, also what Herzl contributed in terms of the blueprint for political Zionism. I think I put the map there. I want you to appreciate just how spread out the different Jewish communities were and where everybody was coming from. But how this fire was lit under us, unfortunately because of anti-Semitism, but ultimately, but when the fire was lit of anti-Semitism, it was back to our traditional sources and to our traditional history that we looked. Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, serving as a model for the world, is an idea that has existed since the dawn of time. And as I guess I pointed out when we first started, when we go through this history, it's not only important to realize how far back the history goes, but it's important to realize what the real potential, what the real significance and meaning of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael is. And I think to do that, we can't start in 1896 with the publication of Der Judenstaat, and we can't start in 1948 with the Hakamat HaMedina. We have to start from the very, very, very beginning of our history, which really ultimately is from the creation of the world. I thank everybody so much for your not only your presence, but your involvement and your passionate interest in this topic. And I hope that it really is the first of many. We'll announce it in Shul. And in 1 or 2 weeks, we're going to be starting it. We're going to do the next unit is going to be on Purim. So it'll be some mixture of the day of Purim, but also a close reading of Megillat Esther. And from there, hopefully that'll keep us going for 4 or 5 weeks. And then from there, we're going to do a 3 or 4 part unit on the Haggadah leading up to Pesach. And after that, we'll figure it out. Thank you, everybody.